Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Judy Joy Jones Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm so glad to have everyone with me tonight because we have a very, very special guest, Reverend Judith Ain, who was to be on our show the other night, but we had a little bit of a technical difficulty. Judith was on a peace walk going around the world, and she became ill with the disease Lyme's. And she is going to talk about that tonight, explaining what it is and what to expect and what it's like to try to get help with it. So I hope you all get anyone you know that might have this to come and listen. She will be calling in just a moment. And when she calls in, I would love, if possible, to take some callers, but I don't guarantee that we'll be able to. She has a lot of information to give out. And while I have the time, let me give you her email. It's lyme-time, T-I-M-E, at stanfordalumni.org. So that's lyme-time at stanfordalumni.org. And you can call, you can email her with any questions you might have that we're not able to answer tonight. Judith actually has had a scholarship to Stanford in physics. And instead of going that direction, she chose to walk around the world and to live her life for peace instead of perhaps building weapons, which is what sometimes people, the physics and physicians are used for. And I'm really glad she did because that's how I met her. We were on a peace walk, actually, and she was the mediator for anything that went wrong. We could all turn and count on Judith to come across with whatever needed to be done. So, and then I talked to her several years after the walk was over and found out that she had contracted this disease, and I was really sorry to hear about it because I had never heard of Lyme's disease, and I told her, you know. But she told me that it was kind of the untouchable disease of our time, that nobody really wanted to know about it or talk about it because it was kind of like the doctors, the insurance companies aren't paying for it, and this and that. So according to Judith, it really is like the obscure disease of our time. I think that out of all the different things that I've heard of, the Lyme's was just simply one I hadn't. And maybe it's because a lot of times it's diagnosed as chronic fatigue or arthritis. It just can have all kinds of different things. And because of that, you know, if I had a friend who said, well, I've got, you know, chronic fatigue, I would have just taken it, you know, taking them at their word. So, but again, the insurance companies just simply have not acknowledged this disease, and therefore it's kind of hard to get, you know, payment for it, and you're kind of out there alone. I know Judith has started some groups, and that really is good because we need, as you know, all the support we can get when you have something like this, where you feel you've got something that nobody else has. And there's many, many people that do have Lyme's, actually. I think she told me California. I'm really not the one, you know, the expert on the disease like Judith, but she told me that there were more diseases of Lyme, I believe, in California than any other state. And you do get the disease through a tick, which is easy to get when you're out and about. And obviously, since Judith was walking around the world for peace, she was sleeping in tents and on, you know, sleeping bags on the ground. So it was very, very easy for her to contact this disease. I think what I'll do is see if she calls in the next 5 minutes. And if she doesn't, I will think perhaps something happened tonight. And we will reschedule one more time. I hope she does, because I did send out the word to a lot of people, and I think she did as well. Judith is really, you know, it has almost put her in the position of being housebound. She just simply can't go out like she did. She's not able to give sermons at the church she's in. And so it's just affected every part of her life. And that was one of the reasons that I wanted to particularly get this information out about the problem. Because if it's that bad and it can just affect everything about your life, then we all need to know about it. Also, I'd like to tell you, I have started a new blog talk, and it will be airing tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, and 10 a.m., that is, California time, and it is called Silent Voices. And what it is I decided there were Silent Voices is dedicated to shedding light on those in history whose cries and thoughts and gifts were unheard. And so there are so many that, I mean, it might have been your mother, your father, or a neighbor, or somebody you knew that spent a lifetime with a silent voice. And so this program will be a place for you to come on board and talk, be the voice for that person, acknowledge and honor that person. So if you, you know of anybody, or I plant the seed, again, it's called Silent Voices. And my first little show is in the morning at 10 o'clock, and you can just type it in. It is case sensitive, silent-voices, OICES. And then you can just call in the switchboard and talk, and perhaps you do know a silent voice. I thought of several silent voices. I was thinking like maybe even the homeless and prisoners and immigrants that come into countries trying to make their life better, because they don't know the language, so they really are living a silent life as they try with everything in them to make their lives better, you know, make their family lives better than they had it. So anyway, that's at 10 o'clock a.m. California time. Check the time tomorrow morning. And it looks like we might have Judith on the air now. Let me go ahead and click. Hello, Judith. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. How are you tonight?
I'm doing all right.
Good. I'm glad to hear your voice.
Well, good day. Good to hear your voice, too.
Oh.
It took me a couple minutes to get the call through.
It is. Was there a little bit of a problem there? Oh.
Yeah, we can't complete your call.
Oh. Oh, well, I didn't know, but I'm so glad you made it through. Yeah. Yeah, this is like prime time, I think, for blog talk.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sure there's 1,000 people calling different shows, but I was kind of sketching out Lyme's disease, Judith, as best I could, which is not that good.
Uh-huh.
But if you know, would like to talk a little bit about how you got it or whatever you'd like to bring up first.
I guess Lyme disease is a tick-borne illness, and I'm not sure exactly where I got it. I'm pretty sure I got it from a tick bite, and my best guess is that I got it when I was camping out in Virginia, or maybe even in the Soviet Union. I was on a walk in the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
And, I had an off-season flu is one of the things that is it can be a sign of the Lyme disease is because the most likely time for people to become infected is in the springtime, because that's when the nymphal ticks are active.
Oh.
And the nymphal ticks are very tiny. Even the adult size of the deer ticks are smaller than a lot of the things like the dog ticks that maybe people are maybe more familiar with. But on the East Coast, the tick that generally is associated with Lyme disease is the Ixodes scapularis, and here on the West Coast in California, it's the Ixodes pacificus. And it's what they call it also a deer tick, black-legged tick is another way of referring to it. And the tiny little nymphal ticks are maybe the size of a poppy seed.
Oh, gee.
So one of the problems with Lyme disease and people getting being aware that they have Lyme disease is that they can be bitten by a tick and not even know it. Because when the ticks bite you, they anesthetize you as they bite. So you may not even feel it biting.
Okay.
And then it can be there biting you and infecting you and then drop off. And you don't even know that it was there, except you may start getting symptoms from the disease.
What were your first symptoms, Judith? That made you go to the doctor?
Well, I was having over a period of time. At the time when I look back, and I think I probably was infected. I was not diagnosed at that time. I was diagnosed. That was in 1989.
Uh-huh.
I was not diagnosed until 2002, late 2002. I had a doctor who recognized that this looked like Lyme disease, and at that time I was having like flu-like symptoms, and I just getting treated for like flu-like symptoms somewhat at the time. But over a period of time, starting in the early early 90s, I started having a lot of weird symptoms. I started having like gross motor tics.
Oh.
It was a Tourette-like tic disorder.
Uh-huh.
And that was like really pretty weird. And I had a lot of generalized pain and tending toward things like chronic fatigue,
right?
A lot of and fibromyalgia type symptoms.
Oh, okay.
So that was it. And one of the things that happened also is that one of the things that Lyme can also do is it can cause any kind of mental illness.
Oh.
Basically. It can potentiate it because it gets into it's the organism that the pathogen that gives people Lyme disease is called Borrelia burgdorferi, or they might call it Borrelia burgdorferi sensu lato. There are other Borrelia spirochetes, which also cause Lyme disease, but they all put it under the Borrelia burgdorferi, which means Borrelia burgdorferi in the general sense.
Mm-hmm.
But those are spirochetes, and that's like a spiral shaped organism, a corkscrew shaped organism.
Uh-huh.
And it's an incredibly sophisticated pathogen. It has 100 or 1500 like active genes.
Oh,
okay. Not active genes. 1500 genes, and then about 132 functioning genes. is a lot. Another a contrast to give you an idea of how complex this organism is. A contrast is to P. pallidum is another spirochete actually, which causes syphilis.
Oh.
And that only has 22 functioning genes as compared to 132 functioning genes.
Oh, my goodness.
And it also has something, it has 21 plasmids, which are, the plasmids are, from my best understanding, are little parts of the DNA that help it to very quickly adapt to different situations. Like when I think that it's the plasmids that when the Borrelia is in the belly of the tick,
right?
And the tick starts feeding on an animal, and the blood of the animal comes into the belly of the tick,
right?
Then the Borrelia will recognize, oh, this is the type of creature I have to get ready to be able to survive and thrive in this kind of creature, and then those plasmids can help it to adapt to best survive in that particular type of animal, whether it's a mouse or a deer or a human being. So the plasmids make it help to make the pathogen very adaptable. And the other thing about the Borrelia organism is that it's a sort of a stealth pathogen, that it has ways of being, when it gets into your system, it tends to go out of the bloodstream into the tissue, and it can get into the brain, and it can get into the spinal fluid, and it can get into the fluid around the joints, which is why I think a lot of people think of Lyme as creating Lyme arthritis. When it was first described, that was what was noticed first, but on the West Coast, actually, it seems like there is a tendency more to have neurological types of Lyme as opposed to the arthritic types of
arthritic.
Lyme.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you have some of both, but that you might even more often see Lyme with different neurological effects.
Well, I know you had mentioned a couple of times that you'd had a rather hard time getting a doctor, or, you know, kind of working with a medical profession.
Yeah.
Why is that? I mean,
well,
is it?
I don't know. I mean, there's some different reasons. I guess I do know in some ways. I've had some health problems over a period of years. So partly I think it was difficult to notice what exactly was going on at first because I'd had a lot of different problems earlier on in my life and some chronic issues leading up to when I think I was infected. Although sometimes I wonder if I was infected even earlier than 1987 when I kind of back to and say, I think that's when it was. But the part of the problem is, I think the way the medical community today is set up is that doctors tend to look for like one diagnosis or one basic set of symptoms, and then they can tend to you know, give you one drug or, you know, a basic protocol to deal with that one thing, and the most doctors, you go in and you only have maybe 15 minutes. And,
oh yeah,
and
sure.
They don't have time to really listen even enough to hear the whole range of symptoms that people can have if they have Lyme disease.
Okay.
Because it's a multi-systemic illness.
I see.
And it's not, one of the things that can be confusing about it is that, I mean, sometimes people will have the type of arthritis where it's in the knee. It's in the knees is a frequent place, I guess, for the Lyme arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes people will have what might be called migratory arthralgias. It's sort of like arthritis-type pain, but maybe at one point it's in your knee or your ankle, or then it's more in your back, or and it's it's not the sort of arthritic kind of condition that people, it's sort of like, well, that's weird. I mean, doctors don't necessarily understand it that well, I don't think. You can say if it's going from one place to another, it's like, well, we can't do orthoscopic surgery because we don't know where it's going to be next.
Right. We don't. Well, you say you feel, I guess, perhaps alienated having this type of disease that's not a household name, or,
yeah.
You know,
well,
it must be rather hard.
Yeah, I think in some ways it may be similar to things like chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia.
Okay.
And actually, chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia in many, or I mean some, I was looking over some stuff from a talk I went some years ago. I went to a conference, the Orthomolecular Health Medicine Conference, that they had on Lyme disease, and one of the speakers was talking about, or I had a slide that an incredibly high percentage of people with fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue tend to test positive for Lyme disease, those may be things that are actually caused by the Lyme pathogen, but they have not been recognized. A lot of people that have Lyme disease are not diagnosed with it.
Not diagnosed. How many people in the United States, do you know, like a rough figure, that have this disease?
Well, I was looking over some different information in preparation. One of the things that I saw an article from last summer, in 2007, or a story that had been on CBS News that was talking, had a warning in it that there's, the CDC thinks there's 200,000 undiagnosed cases of Lyme per year. It's underreported by at least that much.
I get it.
Some of the people, some of the other information that I was looking at, I guess there are some people, you know, or someone that thinks it may be underdiagnosed by a factor of 40, which would make it more like, you know, approaching a million cases a year that may go.
Oh my goodness! Wow.
I'm not sure. I don't know. There are, I think there's approximately somewhat over 20,000 reported cases a year throughout the United States. But one of the problems is the CDC reporting guidelines, you know, the sort of things you have to be counted.
Right.
That not everybody who has Lyme disease has. Like, one of the things that is an initial symptom that many people can get, although it may not even be most people who have Lyme disease, but is a type of a rash called an erythema migrans.
Oh.
It's a bullseye-shaped rash. And if you get a bullseye-shaped rash, even if you don't remember a tick bite, that you should get to the doctor, because that's the bullseye rash can be diagnostic for Lyme disease. And so, you know, if you can't get to the doctor immediately, take a picture of it.
Okay.
It is a good thing to do, to be able to take to your doctor. But there's also other kinds of rashes that can be caused by the Lyme pathogen. And one of the people that I was looking at suggested that some of the other forms of rashes are more common than actually the bullseye rash. But I think the diagnostic criteria of the CDC requires the erythema migrans. I think that may be one of the options, but they have certain things where even a lot of people with Lyme disease may not fall under their categories. It's this weird thing where they have this surveillance criterion, and then there's the clinical criterion.
Uh-huh.
And it's hard to know. It's really hard to
hard to do. Well, how do you get rid of it? I mean, does it just run its course, or do you?
Well, it needs to be treated in one way or another. Some people, one of the things that's very tricky about Lyme disease is people can be infected and be asymptomatic carriers of the pathogen for a period of time, but then something may happen in their life. They may be in an automobile accident or some other sort of physical injury or trauma.
Right.
Or they can have some sort of psychological trauma or emotional upset in their life, and then suddenly they become symptomatic. The stress from, you know, an accident or some emotional trauma can potentiate the Lyme disease, and they become sicker. And that's partly what happened for me. Is I had been getting slowly sicker over a period of time, but then I had an automobile accident, and my neurological symptoms got much worse very quickly.
After the stress on your body.
Even though the automobile accident, the insurance company said, it wasn't that bad. You shouldn't be hurt that bad. But it was, I had this underlying condition that I didn't know about. I didn't know that I had Lyme disease when I had the accident.
When you had the accident,
I had the accident, so it was like, I don't know why I'm having all these weird neurological symptoms from this little whiplash injury.
So you've had it now, you think, even from, what, the 80s, Judith? You've had it that long?
I think so. I think I was really infected then, because I slowly started having sort of tics. At first they were less dramatic tics, but I started having tics within the late 80s. And I started having the gross motor tics where my arms, you know, fly at or around or whatever.
And you can't control it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Do they
have medications for that kind of tics or not?
I'm not sure. I haven't felt like, you know, it's enough of a bother
to
suppress that, you know, or I don't want to take any more medicine than I need to.
They're
not as bad as they used to be. I think maybe, you know, some of the treatment I've been in has
been doing. Because I know when I first reconnected with you, we hadn't spoken in a while, you were actually, I think, on IVs.
May have been. Yeah, I was briefly on IV. Rocephin is one of the IV drugs that's used to treat Lyme. If people are aware, I was bit by a tick, and you know they know, you know, and it was a deer tick, or that I have an erythema migrans, and they go and they can get, if they get adequate oral therapy in the beginning, you know, before, within the first month, I think it is, the sooner the better, and to start treatment, then it can be like, I had Lyme disease many years ago, and it's like not a factor in my life anymore. But if it goes untreated for more than, I don't know, a month or two, I'm not sure exactly where the break off is.
Right.
It can become chronic, and then it becomes very difficult to treat. And the allopathic, well, there's a confusion within the medical community about how to treat Lyme. The Infectious Disease Society of America is only willing to treat the acute phase of Lyme, which is the initial period when people are infected with Lyme.
Right.
They call anything that people may have after that post-Lyme, I think a post-Lyme syndrome. They are not willing to treat it with antibiotics. They just will treat it they'll send you to another doctor to treat it with just symptomatic relief. And relieve whatever symptoms. But there's another, that's one way. And then there's another sort of general group, the that would follow more the ILADS, which is the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society protocols for treating Lyme. And those guidelines, they have evidence-based guidelines, which recommend a whole variety of different types of antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem with Lyme disease, and I think it depends on whether when you're infected by the tick, whether you're just infected with Borrelia, or whether that same tick can also carry a number of other pathogens, which can be very troublesome and difficult to treat and make the treatment of the Lyme disease more complicated. So if the same tick or another tick that you were bitten by, and maybe didn't know it either, you know, was infected with something like Babesia or
mm-hmm.
With anaplasmosis or with Bartonella or Rickettsia, I think, is another one. There's several different ones. Then you have multiple pathogens that you're dealing with, and so it becomes more complicated. The antibiotic that may work on the Lyme pathogen won't necessarily work on the Babesia pathogen, or the Bartonella pathogen.
Right.
And so sometimes if you don't treat, one of the things I've heard is that if you don't treat certain of the other pathogens either together with or maybe even before you try treating the Lyme disease, that the treatment for the Lyme is not as effective.
Oh.
So it's very complicated.
Do you actually, if people want to contact you, Judith, just to throw out the things as I think of them, do you actually have a list of doctors in the area you're in? Let's see, you're in the Santa Cruz, California area, is that right?
Yeah. If people want to contact, I don't want to give out names over the radio.
No, not over the air, but yeah, they could.
But certainly, if people want to contact me, they can contact me. I think you posted my address.
I did. It's Lyme, L-Y-M-E dash time, T-I-M-E at StanfordAlumni.org. So that's Lyme dash time at StanfordAlumni.org.
Alumni, I think.
Alumni, ALUMNI.org.
Yes.
And the show will be archived, so people do listen to it quite a bit after we go off the air. And I'm just trying to think what I would want to know immediately if I thought, oh, gee, maybe this is what I, have, or that somebody I know, oh, this sounds like exactly what they have, and not know exactly. Who to go to or how to find a doctor, where you could kind of cut through all the red tape as to what you're talking about. It could be, in 15 minutes, like you said, they can't really get in there and find out about Lyme's disease, it sounds like.
Sometimes if you're concerned that it may be, you may want to try and get tested. But one of the problems, if it's right away, usually the main test that they use for Lyme disease, it's a pair of tests. Is the first is an ELISA, and the second is a Western blot.
Okay.
And both the ELISA and the Western blot test for the antibody response to Lyme. So your body needs to have made antibodies for the pathogen, and so if you test too soon, your body doesn't have time to have made the specific antigens. So it's sort of like the best time to test is about 7 weeks after you were initially infected.
Okay.
And if you wait too long, to be tested for Lyme disease. After that, the Lyme pathogen has the property that it is able to suppress your immune system. so that you will not be making the antibodies, and so those particular tests may become negative. And some people, from what I understand, some people are will be negative, will test, you know, with those particular tests be negative until they've started treating. So Lyme is actually a clinical diagnosis. So it's really important to find a doctor who really understands Lyme disease.
Well, is there a certain age that gets it that gets this disease more frequently than another, or is it?
I don't know that there's any age, age things. I mean, it's just it has to do with exposure to ticks, and part of that may be, I mean, people go out camping or hiking or. The most risky behavior for. Getting exposed to a tick, the ticks, if you're in the endemic area, is sitting by a tree or sitting on a log or collecting wood. Those are the most risky, the ways that you're most likely to be exposed.
Could you repeat that? Sitting by a log, sitting by
sitting
a tree or
log,
what?
Sitting next to it with your back against a tree or something. Like
okay.
Or, yeah, collecting, like firewood, collecting wood. So it's having any contact with wood.
With
and,
wood,
and
okay.
Usually in coastal California, where I am,
yes.
From what I understand, that the primary tick habitat for the Ixodes pacificus tick, which is the one that carries Lyme disease, is oak woodland. And what that means is that if there's an oak tree anywhere in the area, then that's oak woodland. And it and just because there's also a bunch of redwood trees or other kinds of trees around, don't let that fool you. If there's oak trees there, that's oak woodland. I get that sort of confused. Because the mice and I guess deer can carry the Lyme disease, but they tend to feed on the acorns of the oak trees.
Of the oak
and
tree.
So the you know when there's extra big blooms of acorns, then there can be more of the reservoir creatures to carry the Lyme disease, and then more of the ticks, and so that can be a more dangerous time for infection.
Okay, so those are a few tips about. Just kind of putting your back, sitting, don't spend a lot of time just with your back resting on the tree or carrying firewood, and particularly if you don't know what kind of tree you're dealing with, right?
And if you're out in, if you're out camping or in some, any of the woodland, you know, any oak woodland area, you know, by, you know, maybe occasionally, you know, even while you're out there or certainly at the end of the day, do a tick check. You know, like go, you know, you can look, you know, all over your body or have somebody, if you have a partner, you know, check one another.
Check,
And they recommend that a tactile check, like feeling, taking your hand and feeling for the tick can be more helpful than just the visual check because some of the ticks are very tiny.
Tiny.
And so it sometimes you can feel them almost better than you can see them and more readily. But the other problem is not only being out there, but if you live in an area that, you know, where there's oak trees or and if you have pets, and if your pets go outside, and even if you don't go outside,
you
can bring the ticks back in.
Oh, my gosh.
You just have to be aware and be aware of the potential risks for exposure and just, I mean, do the tick checks is a good thing. And
that's
then if you find one that's attached, then, it's good to know the one proper way to remove a tick. There's a lot of folk ways of removing ticks, which are not recommended. And the one recommended way to remove a tick is to use tweezers and grasp the tick by the mouth part between the body of the tick and the skin where it's attached. And you don't want to squeeze the body of the tick, because if the tick is attached, it's sort of like it's a little syringe that's, you know, that's sticking into your bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
And if you squeeze the body of the tick, it's like you'll be injecting yourself with whatever's in the tick, which you don't want to do. That's the and so you grasp it by the mouth part between the body of the tick and the skin, and you pull straight back, no twisting.
No twisting.
Firmly, you know, firmly and slowly and firmly, and hopefully the tick will release so that the mouth parts are not left in the skin. But in the CDC brochure, they say don't worry if the mouth parts are left in the skin. And in any case, when you pull the tick out, you want to put some sort of antiseptic where the bite was.
Where the bite was, okay.
Yeah, so you want to try and kill anything that might cause any kind of infection, whether it's with Borrelia or other germs that might be hanging out. And one of the reasons that I didn't know this, but we have a woman in our support group who is incredibly knowledgeable, and she was saying that I think it's Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
Mm-hmm.
If the tick is infected with that, that you can get infected if you just touch the tick.
Okay.
You don't even, and so that's why you want to use. That's one of the reasons you want to use tweezers.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure how much Rocky Mountain spotted fever we actually have in this area. I don't think we have a lot, but it's. It's being careful is the best. Option.
So you are in a support group. Are there many support groups around the United States, other states, Judith, or do you know?
I think there are. Yeah, I think there are support groups in a lot of different places. There's one of the there's like the some websites that might be good to look into, and I think there's probably links. I mean, you can just put Lyme disease support group wherever.
Oh, sure.
In a Google search engine.
Right.
And you'll probably be able to find things. But site that can take you to a number of different things. I think it may actually take you to some different support groups. Or have links to some different support groups is LymeNet. LymeNet.org. And that has links to a lot of different kinds of information related to Lyme disease. And
what was that again? LymeNet?
LymeNet. Yeah.
LymeNet, okay.
Yeah.
LymeNet.
LymeNet.
M-E-T, okay. N-E-T, net. All right. Well,
And they're on their, I'm on the page right now. And
oh, you're on it, okay.
A link, there is, you can go to nothing that says support groups. And then you can search for them one place and another.
Well, that's good to know for anybody
helpful.
Out there.
There are online support groups. I mean, one of the things that we have a lot more people in Santa Cruz County who have Lyme disease than who come to the support group or are able. Some of them are in the online support group, but they're not well enough even to come to the support group.
Oh. So they do it online. Well, that's a good thing. They are able to do it online, and that way, so it can absolutely make you almost an invalid. Is that right, Judith?
Yeah, people can become very sick. I mean, one of the things that's interesting, one of the things, Lyme is called the great, the, I guess maybe the second great imitator, the one of the diseases that was called the great imitator is syphilis. Untreated syphilis can manifest as all kinds of different things. It's also a spirochete. It can cause insanity. It can cause, you know, all different kinds of symptoms.
Oh my gosh!
And you know, it presents like all different other things. And so if you don't figure out that that's not what it is, it's Lyme disease or it was syphilis. You don't treat it and you just end up having more and more of the symptoms, whatever they are.
Well, of course, you can weed out syphilis pretty easy. Isn't that just a blood test?
Syphilis is much more readily treated. I think it may have to do with that. You know, it had it had like 22 active genes, whereas Borrelia has 130. Some active genes. It's not as complicated. It's not as sophisticated as an organism. Even if untreated, it can do a lot of damage. But it's more susceptible to being treated by antibiotics. And so it can be treated with antibiotics. And it's not as, I'm not sure how long a course of antibiotics you need for syphilis, but I don't think it's extremely long like the need can be in Lyme disease.
Yeah, so if you went to your doctor, they could rule out syphilis right away easier than the Lyme's disease. And that would, I would think that from what you've told me, I would want to be really ready, you know, with all the, what I can find out before I find a doctor even. I suppose there would be doctors that just wouldn't even think to look for this, right, Judith?
Oh, a lot of, many doctors would not even think of looking for this. One of the things that's unfortunate in Santa Cruz County, we have the highest known adult tick infection rate in the state of California.
Oh my gosh!
It may be higher someplace else. It's just there's no studies that have been done that show a higher rate anyplace else. And unfortunately, there are doctors in Santa Cruz County who say, we don't have Lyme disease here.
Okay.
I mean, they just, that's an East Coast disease. Because it was first described back in Lyme, Connecticut, there tends to be this assumption that it's back in East Coast disease. It's not.
We were talking even that the homeless population, a lot of homeless people might have it since they live outside.
Yeah, I'm not sure. There are one of the studies. One of the places that some of the homeless stay in here in Santa Cruz is endemic. Not necessarily so much with Lyme disease, but I think it's ehrlichiosis that's in the park area where they that's the disease that has a higher infection rate. But that isn't, that's another one of the tick-borne diseases, which...
And what is that called?
Well, it's ehrlichiosis or anaplasmosis. They changed the name,
But that would definitely be something that the homeless would be susceptible to, sleeping outside and living outside.
Yeah, with the ticks and the ticks.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and it could, who knows? It's really hard to know what is going on, and there may be just incredibly more people that have been infected than we realize, and you know there may be just a whole lot of asymptomatic carriers. And, you know, it's hard to know why, you know, some people get really sick with it and then maybe some other people have it in their blood, but they don't. They get sick.
That would make an interesting study.
That can be true also with the babesiosis. Babesiosis is one of the tick-borne diseases, which is a malarial type organism.
Oh.
It's a blood parasite.
Oh.
And And so anybody who has Ehrlichiosis, it's a lifetime ban on donating blood.
Lifetime ban.
Mm-hmm. Lifetime ban. You can't donate blood. And I have a friend back in the East Coast who her husband worked at a park. And
mm-hmm.
he was healthy, and he didn't have any, wasn't aware of any health issues, and he was a regular blood donor until
right.
he found out that he had infected somebody else with babesiosis from his blood.
Oh.
That he was infected without knowing it.
Didn't know it.
And then, so it's, you know, some people can get very sick with it. It can be a very debilitating disease, but then sometimes people, they may be infected with it and not even know it.
And you can pass it on with a blood transfusion.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether Lyme can be passed on through blood transfusions or not.
You don't know. Okay. So there's
I don't know. I mean, one of the things, babesiosis is a red blood cell parasite. It gets into your red blood cells. And, whereas Borrelia it tends to go hide out in your tissue rather than.
Mm-hmm. Hello? Uh-oh. I think we lost Judith. I don't know. She should be calling back in a minute. And in the meantime, we'll wait for her and see. Yeah, I wanted to especially have this program and have it in the archives so that anyone that suspects they might have Lyme's or know someone that might have some symptoms that are that definitely point towards Lyme's disease, because I know that the people that do have it are having an especially hard time getting help, getting diagnosed, and it's people like Judith that are getting out here and trying to share with all of us that make a difference on this type of obscure disease, although the number of people, according to her, that have it are vast amounts. So that's why I really am grateful to Blog Talk Radio for making this type of program available to anyone that might have this. I feel that there are so many things that go, you know, that we could get and this and that, but if you know what it is, that's number one, and that's going to put your mind to rest in some way. And you can also get in a support group. As Judith mentioned, you can go online and Google it and just put in Lyme support group. And Lyme is L-Y-M-E. And then put in your state, your city, and surely you could find something close by. And then, like she also spoke of, they do have the online support group. So that's good to know. If you're not able to, you know, you may live in some area that just simply doesn't have that. I want to go ahead, in case she's not able to get back on the switchboard for whatever reason, her cell may have gone. But let me give you one more time her contact information. And her name is Judith Ain, A-I-N. And her email is Lyme, Lyme-time, T-I-M-E, at StanfordAlumni.org. And that's Stanford, the college, Stanford, S-T-A-N-F-O-R-D, alumna, A-L-U-M-N-I.org. And I don't see her coming back on the switchboard, so it may be that whatever happened, it might be on the tech end of Blog Talk Radio. But if you would like to contact her for any other information, feel free to do so, because I know she's more than happy to assist anyone in helping them get what they need for this particular type of disease. And I want to thank everybody for listening tonight, and hopefully you will know that those archives are there and you'll be able to just point people to them. They're free, and this is the sort of thing where the information is not going to never be not needed. So at least we kind of scratch the surface, and of course we can definitely have Judith back and take calls at that time. So anyway, I think I'm going to wrap it up for the night and just tell everyone good night and hope you have a beautiful tomorrow. And just keep thinking loving thoughts, and I'm sending everybody a lot of light. And so we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.